This reading today about reincarnation, the spiral staircase, put me in mind of myself as a little girl growing up in San Francisco. And I lived in a very small neighborhood, the Haight-Ashbury, in a family that was devoutly Catholic. And my experience was defined by family at home, by church, St. Agnes, and by school, St. Agnes. And that was it when I was little. It was like being in a village, and everything in that village was pretty much in sync. There were mostly Irish Catholics and Irish Filipinos, Catholic Filipinos. So St. Agnes. St. Agnes is an early Christian martyr, and every January was her feast day. So the nuns, the dear nuns whom we loved and who loved us, would tell us the story of St. Agnes. And in case you don't know it, here it is. She lived in about the 3rd century AD. And she was the young child of a very wealthy Roman family, a noble family. When she became 12 years of age, which was a marriageable age, one of the prefects of the area decided that she would be the perfect wife for his son. But he hadn't thought it through, because Agnes had already given her heart to God and her body, and she had taken a vow of virginity. So she turned down this offer. It did not please him. And because he was so furious with her, he denounced her as a Christian. Now, that was the time of Emperor Diocletian. And it was not a good thing to be a Christian. As a matter of fact, your fate was sealed off to be the victim of the gladiators, or off to be the victim of the lions in the Colosseum. However, caveat, because no virgin could be executed. So he was really stymied. Now, the next part of the story, the nuns left out. They skipped all the way to the end. They told us that she was indeed martyred, and she ended up in the lexicon of the great early Christian martyrs, and we venerated her for that. We venerated her courage. What they didn't tell us was that the prefect, whose name I can't remember, arranged to have her dragged off to a brothel to take care of the problem of virginity. But the miraculous came in and saved her. And over again, he tried to take care of this little problem. And over again, he was stymied by grace-filled Agnes. Until in the very end, he did succeed in having her beheaded. So you can imagine, I'm little, I hear this story, and I really take it to heart. Because the caveat was that if you were a martyr, you would go directly to heaven. And that sounded like a good deal to me. I didn't think about how in San Francisco in the mid-50s there were few opportunities for martyrdom. But it still made sense to me. And it was only when I came to this path that I encountered the teaching of reincarnation. And I can tell you what a relief it was to go from a small, little, boxed-in view of the soul's destiny to something that had so much more room for us, for our individual efforts, for our individual lesson plans. And so it was a relief, really, the first time around, because I thought, you know, you have infinite chances to get it right. And as a teacher, I work in Living Wisdom School, I know the value of that. We work with children all the time who, they don't get it right the first time. And then it's my job to say, oh, but you will. You will. We'll work on it together. Just put out a little effort. And then, you know, there are always those wonderful sparkling moments when they do. And you see over a period of years that trajectory of growth and empowerment and expertise and refinement that comes to children who put out the effort. So that was the one part of it. But the other part of it was, well, yes, you have infinite possibilities, but that could go on for infinity. And that was a little discouraging. And I thought, oh my. And then, we hear the stories of the beautiful disciple. I think it was of Chaitanya, I'm not sure, who asked the master, all the disciples were gathered, and they asked the master, Master, how long will it be before I achieve enlightenment? And the master said, well, for you, a certain number of lifetimes, and for you, a certain number of lifetimes. And for you, this one poor soul, he said, probably around, and he named a big figure, like maybe 2,000. I don't remember the exact. And the other disciples thought, oh my goodness, and they just felt terrible for their guru bhai. But he said, thank you, master, and he left the room. And they later sought him out, thinking that they would have to give him great consolation. And instead, what did they find? They found this young disciple rejoicing, dancing. And they said, why are you dancing? He said, because I am eventually going to be enlightened. I'm going to achieve samadhi. And he had figured out the attitude that was the only attitude to have. That no matter how deeply the nail is embedded in the board, if we keep pulling it out and pulling it out, eventually it comes free. So I had a kind of course correction when I came on this path, and a sense of, first, the freedom to look at what came to me and claim it for my own. I'm reminded of a story that happened with my grandson Hardy recently. Hardy went to the dentist, and I don't know if this was his first time. It might have been. He's 3 and a half. And apparently, the dentist was inspired to talk to Hardy very seriously about the relationship between candy and cavities. And Hardy got the lesson because Halloween came up the following week. And he went out and he had his little bag of goodies and he brought it home and it was full and his mother got the bowl out and they put it all in the bowl and she offered him some candy. And she said, you can have a few pieces, Hardy. He says, no, no, I don't want any candy. And she said, Hardy, you can really have a piece or two. I mean, it's fine. No, Mom, I don't want any candy. And his father said, Hardy, have one piece. It's Halloween. And Hardy said, he thought about it for a moment. And he said, okay, but bring me my toothbrush. And aside from the absolute charm of that, I thought to myself, isn't that encouraging? He understands already the relationship between cause and effect and is willing to bring into the situation his willpower. And that is a recipe for tremendous success. And he's only 3 and a half. Of course, I think the tests get bigger and bigger, don't they? It's not so much of a piece of candy, although we have our symbolic candy that we have to say, oh no, 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 no candy. And there is no toothbrush that's going to cover that. So we have this concept of empowerment that we can do it and that we must do it and that if we don't do it, it's going to come around again and again. And that's a great incentive. That whole image of the spiral staircase from our reading struck me when I first read that years ago as so apt, because isn't it true that when things come to us, things that are problematic, things that are difficult, things that test us to the very core of our being, isn't it always true that there's some little piece there that might seem familiar? Oh yes, I remember you. And now from the vantage point of increasing old age, I can look back and I have many more opportunities to see those patterns accumulate and to be humbled by it. And my humility really takes two forms. One is, oh my gosh, I guess I didn't do that right the last time. And then the other side of it is, oh, isn't it great? I'm going to get a chance to set it straight this time, if I can. And to muster up with all the courage in my being to do it better. There was a little girl in the third grade who one day was discovered by her teacher tearing up her spelling test. And she hadn't gotten a good score on it. She was so ashamed. And the teacher, her job had been to put the test in the homework, go home, look at the words that she had missed, master them again, and try it over. But she just couldn't bring herself to do that. And the teacher, in her wisdom, had the inspiration to say to her, oh, you really, really care about your spelling, don't you? Through the tears. And she said, the teacher said to the little girl, that is such a good thing. That is the beginning of being able to do it. And together we will work on it. And So often I take these things that happen in the school as little microcosms for all those things that are happening in my own life and in the lives of the parents who come to me and say, Helen, what are we going to do? And there's a lot of that going on. Because what is the purpose of life? The only purpose of life, as our reading tells us, is to move through, yet again, this set of circumstances which will ultimately bring us to God. The quality for today, perseverance, couldn't be more apt. Because that's what it's going to take. That loyalty to the goal. And mustering everything forward with that. We had an example of perseverance happen last week that was pretty dramatic. And I was so pleased as the director of the school that our children rose to the challenge under the guidance of their teacher. And this is something that we can all aspire to. We had the fourth, fifth graders go out on a field trip. They were going to experience the concepts in the classroom they had been studying. Longitude, latitude, map reading, geography. And so off they go with their teacher, Craig, to the Montebello Open Space Preserve or somewhere near there. And I don't know if you know about it. I hadn't known about this before. There's such a thing as treasure hunt. It's an internet treasure hunt, geocaching. Did I get it right, Craig? Where people leave things in certain places and other people go online or use their smartphones and they find the place and then they go search for it and then there's this treasure. So you can imagine how absolutely riveting that would have been for the children. And I was thrilled for them. So off they go. They're walking down this path and they find the first cache. And they look in it and they're very excited and they say, okay, let's go to the next one. And they continue on down the path. When all of a sudden, the boys in the lead begin to feel something, and they start swatting, and then they realize what's happening. There are some wasps, and they run ahead. And yet, the girls who were at the end of the line didn't know what was happening, and what had really happened was that they had inadvertently upset a ground nest of wasps. And so the girls kept coming on, and all of a sudden, they swarmed. And they're all around them. They're in their hair. They're on their jackets. They're up their sleeves. They're up their pants legs. They're stinging. And it was pandemonium. I had a similar experience on another field trip some years ago that was not quite as intense. So I know what they were feeling between the pain and the bewilderment and just that whole spontaneous need to react. And Craig kept his presence of mind. And he said to the girls, because they wouldn't take their jackets off, they couldn't, they were paralyzed. He said, stop. Breathe. And this is what we do at Living Wisdom School. We breathe a lot. I don't mean that way. I mean really calm, conscious, focused breathing. A child falls down and there's a little blood. And there are tears and hysteria. The teacher, the first thing, will say, breathe. And then we can proceed. So he said, breathe. And believe it or not, with the wasps swarming, They stood there and they took deep breaths. And then they said to him in the moment, Craig, how come you're not crying out? Aren't they stinging you? You must not be getting stung. And he said, no, I'm breathing. I'm getting stung, but I'm breathing. And they said, take off your jacket. Take off everything. Run. And they did. They dropped the backpacks. They dropped the cell phone. They dropped their jackets and off they ran. And it was titillating in a way. So they went back to the van. And they were upset, and every little leaf that fell on them, oh, another wasp, you can imagine. But they got back to the van, and Craig said to them, you know, I have to go back. I left the cell phone, the backpack, and all your jackets. Does anybody want to come with me? And there was one boy. I'll go with you, Craig. And off they went. So they pick it up, and by the time they got there, guess what? There were no wasps. And he got it all back to the van, and everybody cheered, and one little girl said, you know, Craig, you didn't get stung this time, and I was doing my ohms for you. So, I mean, it's a great story, isn't it? It's a great story, and it's a great parable for what's possible in the midst of an intense test. That if we can, even as we are getting stung by the wasps of life, if we can go within, even momentarily, catch our breath, center ourselves, and then act, everything comes out. Now, that's hard to do. Nobody denies it. But if fourth and fifth graders, in the midst of a swarm of wasps, can do it, then so can we. And we must do it. That is our destiny. We must do it. Do we do it alone? Oh, no. We have so much help. We have, of course, all of these teachings, but we have more than that. We have the assurance of the masters that they are there walking with us step by step. Krishna said to Arjuna, Arjuna, no devotee of mine will ever perish. The only outcome will be success, in other words. The only question is, how long? And Jesus gave us the parable of the prodigal son, in which he describes what it's going to be like when the soul makes that spiral for the last time around that staircase going up to God. And it's going to be the father waiting there with open arms, ordering the fatted calf, saying, bring the rich robes and the jewels. My son has returned. That's our welcome. And also, there's Master. And Master wrote that beautiful, beautiful poem, God's Boatman. And I have to read a little bit from it. I don't have it by heart. But when I was preparing this, you know, it's so touching. The year, I still remember the year the school did the school play and on Yogananda. And Mara was master. And she practiced this poem. We had the boat, we had the pole, and she's poling the boat. And she's saying that there was such a feeling in the audience when she did that. Master wrote, I want to ply my boat many times across the gulf after death, and return to Earth's shores from my home in space. And in our Festival of Light, we hear there's no greater love than to go from those beautiful, beautiful astral causal worlds, from unity with God, back into that body, which Master described as a very heavy overcoat, very unwieldy, very uncomfortable when he first got into the body. And he says, I want to load my boat with all those waiting, thirsty ones who have been left behind. Take heart, that's us. That I may carry them to the opalescent pool of iridescent joy, there where my Father distributes his all-desire-quenching liquid peace. Oh, I will come back again and again, crossing a million crags of suffering with bleeding feet, I will come. If need be, a trillion times. As long as I know that one stray brother is left behind. So there will never be a moment where we are doing this by ourselves. There will always be that presence of Master, and all that remains for us is to ply our boat in that direction towards the top of that spiral staircase, understanding that ultimately our only rest, our only joy will be in God. Bless you.